Public Broadcasting, and from the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Support for today's broadcast comes from World Gourmet Foods, now in their new location at 105 Krispy Kreme Drive in Bloomington, serving the area with gourmet foods from around the world. Their grand opening will be held on Saturday, September 13th, with a large food show featuring more than 500 samples. Information at worldgourmetfoods.com.
It's 106. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Tom Rogers, and for Celeste Quinn, we go to the archives for this next interview in the 1 o'clock hour from August 13th. As it's a pre-recorded program, we're not taking phone calls this afternoon.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, the inside story of a landmark Supreme Court case involving executive power. Our guest is journalist Jonathan Mahler. He is the author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, and the Fight Over Presidential Power. Here's a little background on the story. More than 250 suspects are being held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. 20 have been charged. Last week, the first week of August 2008, the trial and sentencing of Salim Hamdan, a former driver for Osama bin Laden, was completed. It was the first trial at Guantanamo, and it was seen largely as a defeat for the prosecution. Hamdan was acquitted of conspiring with al-Qaeda to attack the U.S. He was found guilty of one count of providing material support for terrorism. Prosecutors argued for a sentence of 30 years. He was given a sentence of 5.5 years. It's unclear what will happen to Hamdan when he completes his sentence. Given credit for time already served, he will complete the sentence in 5 months. The Bush administration, meanwhile, says it can hold detainees until the end of the war on terror. The case we'll be talking about this afternoon, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, involved Salim Hamdan. It was decided by the Supreme Court at the end of June in 2006. In a 5-3 vote, the court ruled that the president had overstepped his authority in ordering military tribunals. It said the tribunals, as had been planned, would violate U.S. laws and the Geneva Conventions. Our guest this afternoon, Jonathan Mahler, is a contributing editor for the New York Times Magazine. The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power, is his second book. His first was Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jonathan Mahler's book, The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power, is published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Jonathan Mahler, good to talk with you. How are you?
I'm fine. It's my pleasure to be here.
I gave a cursory summary of this case. Would you care to give us some more background and tell us about the impact, the import of the Supreme Court's decision in this case?
Sure. The case basically was brought by a Navy JAG lawyer, Charlie Swift, Lieutenant Commander Charles Swift, who was appointed to represent Hamdan, appointed by the Pentagon to represent Hamdan back in 2003 when he was first designated for trial by these military tribunals. It was brought by Swift, and principally by Swift and a young law professor at Georgetown by the name of Neil Katyal. And the two of them essentially were alleging in this lawsuit that these tribunals were illegal for a number of reasons. The first being that that the president had essentially unilaterally authorized them, that he hadn't gone to Congress, and that was a violation of the separation of powers. And the other kind of main prong of the lawsuit was the fact that that the trials themselves had to comport with the ground rules set out in the Geneva Conventions, that the president had to observe the Geneva Conventions, though the administration argued that, in fact, that he didn't. So on both of those counts, they won. So as a result, the president, in the aftermath of the decision, had to ask Congress basically to write new rules for the tribunals that would be approved by Congress and be essentially U.S. law. And he also had to make a great number of policy changes because it was now clear that the Geneva Conventions applied to our treatment of enemy combatants in the war on terror. So, for instance, he had to shut down this network of secret prisons that were in foreign countries where we were rendering suspected terrorists for interrogation outside the purview of the federal courts. Mm. So, just to give you a little more background on the book and. Essentially, the book tells the story of I've just given you a lot of law, but the book really tells the story. It's really, really written for more of a mainstream audience, not law professors, and it tells the story of these two guys, Swift and Katyal, and this kind of amazing legal odyssey, and the idea that you have this this Navy officer, a member of the U.S. military, not only putting up this extraordinarily vigorous defense of an accused terrorist, insisting on his innocence, but in fact turning around after being appointed by the Pentagon to defend the guy, he turns around and sues President Bush over the lawfulness of the system he was to be tried in. So it's really kind of an extraordinary story of patriotism in a way. So in the book, I really tell the story of these two lawyers and this legal odyssey, and I also tell the story of Hamdan himself, where he's from, what brought him to jihad, and in particular, what his life was like on Guantanamo and what his relationship with Swift was like, because you can imagine a guy, Hamdan had been in custody, in U.S. custody for 2.5 years when he was assigned to Swift and had been interrogated dozens of times. And into his cell one day walks a guy in a Navy uniform saying, "Hi, I'm your lawyer. You can trust me. I'm here to help you." Swift had his work cut out for him, earning Hamdan's trust, and then continuing to earn it back over and over again over the course of many years, really. I mean, this all began, as I said, in 2003. Hamdan went on numerous hunger strikes, had to be force-fed in a restraining chair. He fired Swift repeatedly. So it's also really the story of this very unusual relationship.
Yeah. Well, let's start with Charlie Swift. You write he was, by both reputation and self-profession, one of the most zealous defense attorneys in the JAG Corps. Tell us a little bit about him in terms of what led him to the military, what led him to the law, mm-hmm. and why is he such a zealous fellow?
Yeah, well, sure. He went to the Naval Academy barely made it. I mean, he nearly failed out. He was got into disciplinary trouble on numerous occasions, but he did make it, and then went off into do his naval service. And he was never a great fit in the military, in a sense, because he was a sort of insubordinate, I guess, by nature, and was a guy who sort of naturally inclined to defend the underdog and fight the system. On the other hand, I think he kind of, at a certain point, came to sort of revel in that role. He felt comfortable being that guy, being the guy who was kind of taking on the man, taking on the system, and which served him well as a JAG lawyer, because he became a defense lawyer in the military. And here he was representing servicemen against the government, against the Navy, who would basically be prosecuting these guys for whatever they had done, be it possession of cocaine or robbery or whatever it was. He's a big guy, big barrel-chested guy, blonde hair, blue eyes, Very, very garrulous, very just a, kind of a lovable, very wears his heart on his sleeve kind of guy. And as a lawyer, he's someone who really relies on building close relationships with his clients. He feels like he needs to get to know them. He needs them to trust him. And what he tries to do basically is you know, build a counter narrative, you know, to tell their side of the story and sort of know who they are so he can do that. And, you know, in the case of Hamdan, it was a, you know, especially unusual situation because he had to sort of, you know, get to know a guy who couldn't have been from a more more different background.
Mm. What did he think of Hamdan, or does that even enter into the equation?
Well, I mean, he certainly has you know, come to feel incredibly warmly towards him. I mean, I think they've just built this very intense relationship, and so, you know, I think he was unbelievably frustrated with him at times, and angry, and you know, put upon. But ultimately, I think he really honestly came to like Hamdan, has come to like Hamdan.
Mm. How did he begin to earn his trust?
Yeah, well, it was mainly persistence. He went back, just you know, kept going back to Guantanamo, kept doing everything he could to improve Hamdan's living conditions, to fight this legal fight on his behalf, to reassure him that he was going to get him more rights, that he was going to get him a fair trial. You know, I tell the story, I mean, in the book about one of their first meetings. It was their second meeting. Swift has come in just the day before and presented himself and said he was his lawyer, and of course Swift didn't imagine that Hamdan really believed that he was there to help him, but Swift laid out for him what he wanted to do. He said, the government wants you to plead guilty. And Hamdan said, to what? And Swift said, well, they haven't given me the charge yet, but they want you to plead guilty. And Hamdan said, well, how can I plead guilty if I don't even know what the charge is? And Swift said, well, I have another idea. And Swift told him that his idea was actually to plead not guilty and to sue the Bush administration over the lawfulness of these trials, claiming that essentially Hamdan's rights had been violated by these trials, were being violated by these trials. And Swift, you know, then explained some of the legal issues, the Geneva Conventions, et cetera, and Hamdan is kind of looking at him, really, really not following him. This is a man with a fourth grade education who comes from a country that you know, has Sharia law. So, but Swift goes ahead and sort of proceeds with an explanation of what he's doing. And at the end of the meeting, Swift says, "Think about it. I'll be back in a few days." Stands up to leave. He says, "Solemn, do you believe I'm here to help you?" And Solemn says, "A drowning man will cling to any hand that's extended to him." Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent that was one of the things that ultimately drove Hamdan's willingness to trust him, was that he was the only guy who was coming down there and saying he was there to help. So Hamdan didn't have much of a choice.
Yeah. Now, the Defense Department wanted lawyers who would be loyal to the administration's trial process. The lawyers weren't expected to mount much of a defense, if any.
That's right.
How was that message communicated?
Yeah, well, it was very clearly communicated when Swift was assigned to Hamdan, and the letter, the appointing letter, the letter that appointed him to defend Hamdan, said, "You will be granted access to Mr. Hamdan for as long as the plea negotiations continue." So basically, Swift flew down to Guantanamo thinking, well, this may be my last meeting with my own client, because the government is telling me that I can only meet with him if we're in talks for a guilty plea. I can only basically guide him on how to plead guilty. I'm not here to talk to him about how we can what sort of defense we can mount. And you know, during the course of my research, I spoke at length with the first prosecutor who actually chose Hamdan to be the first defendant in these tribunals. He's out of the military now himself, but you know, he told me that the Defense Department, the civilians in the Defense Department, kept saying, you know, that you know, these guys are going to plead guilty, and these lawyers are going to roll over for us, basically. And he was, even this guy, this JAG prosecutor, was saying, no, you guys have it wrong. They're not going to. But no one believed him, and of course he turned out to be right about that.
How was it decided that Hamdan would be the first to be tried?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there were a lot of factors. And one was that, first you have to keep in mind that this was a number of years ago. So, since then we've captured a lot of what are known as high-value detainees, people who were directly involved in 9/11 and in other al-Qaeda conspiracies. And Hamdan was captured really, early on in November of 2001. And one of the things that the prosecutor told me he liked about Hamdan was that he was able to really trace his journey in U.S. custody. So he felt that he'd never been rendered to any foreign countries for interrogation. So he felt that he felt a clean case. There wouldn't be allegations that he'd been tortured. Now, as it turned out, on the very first day of his military tribunal, Hamdan's lawyers argued that some of his statements to interrogators should be barred because he'd been tortured, they'd been coerced, and the judge agreed, and he barred quite a few of his statements. So there was that issue, and there was also the fact that Hamdan was actually a very cooperative detainee as a witness. I mean, in his interrogations, he was cooperative. He answered questions. He actually took people around to where bin Laden had been after 9/11 when he was in Afghanistan, and so they had a lot of confessions from him. So they felt that they had a strong case as well. The other thing is that Hamdan had been with bin Laden for many years. He'd been with him from 1996 to until the aftermath of 9/11. So there was a sense, I think, that one could kind of use him to tell the whole story of al-Qaeda's jihad against America. So whether or not Hamdan had been directly involved in this jihad, he was with bin Laden during this period of time, and for narrative purposes, he would be an effective defendant.
At the outset, though, I'm sure they had no inkling that also what would be hinted at the very least was the ineptness of the government in handling him.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think I think that certainly had they known at the time that at the end of the day he was going to be only convicted on one charge of the lesser of the charges he faced and sentenced to what amounts to 4 months, frankly, after time served, they would have chosen someone else.
Yeah. At some point in the story, you quote Swift as saying, "Are we supposed to just run a losing play?"
Right.
And, one wonders how it was that he was selected. Did his superiors know what they were getting with Swift?
Yeah. Well, I think that they should have, because even as a JAG lawyer, he had been a very, very zealous defense lawyer. But what I think they didn't expect was the "are we supposed to run a losing play?" That's basically what that refers to was that one of his superiors, he was complaining even before he'd been assigned to Hamdan, he was complaining about some of the rules for these military tribunals that he thought were illegal, and illegal both under U.S. law and under the Geneva Conventions. And this superior said, "Well, you want to challenge the lawfulness of these tribunals and the rules, you bring that challenge right in the tribunal." And so I said, "Well, no, I don't want to bring this challenge to, he said, first he said, "Are we supposed to run a losing play?" Because that had been tried before in the Tokyo tribunals after World War II. But what Swift really meant was, "I don't want to bring the challenge at the military tribunals. I want to bring the challenge in federal court. I want an independent judge, not a military judge appointed by the Pentagon. I want an independent, unelected, independent judge to rule on whether or not these things are fair." And that was something that the administration was not prepared for. And the other thing that the administration was not prepared for, I think above all, was the fact that Swift wouldn't simply make this defense. He mounted a very public campaign. He talked to the media about how unfair he thought these trials were, and he really pushed to change the public perception of these trials. And that is something that I think that the government really wasn't prepared for, because there's an unwritten code in the military and the JAG Corps that you don't talk out of school, and it was for him to really go to the media and make this an issue was surprising, and ultimately I think was a factor in sort of the demise of his military career, frankly.
Yeah. Journalist Jonathan Mahler is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author most recently of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Champaign County on line one. Hi.
Hi. I think it's really worthy to note to what happened when the judge was sentencing him, and this business about the judge saying, "I hope you're reunited with your family."
Sure. Yeah.
It's in some months, and the pressure is really on, mm-hmm. The Bush administration has been finessing Supreme Court rulings, it seems like. Maybe finesse isn't the right word, because it's kind of ham-handed, the way they're getting around them.
Ignoring?
Yeah, I mean, you can go to the Constitution. The Constitution actually gives the incarceration during wartime duties explicitly to the Congress.
Congress, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's
right.
It's not often noted that's really, and I think they've really mostly been abdicating as well broader responsibilities too. But what I wanted to get at is, and this will probably complicate things too thoroughly, but what do you make of this Siddiqui case, the woman who was accused of picking up a loose AK or M16? And
right. I've only heard just snippets about it. I haven't
okay.
read about it.
Well, what I'm getting at is, why are they, they don't seem to be responding to the direction that they should give some kind of judicial review in a serious way. Why are they picking her out of Afghanistan and trying her in a court in this country? And it seems to me that they're so often their motives are actually sort of PR and public relations, that they're wanting to, in a way, distract people from this case.
Yeah.
And summon this image of this murderous woman, Al-Qaeda fanatic, who,
right.
There's so many loose ends about her story. She may have been in a CIA prison for the last 4 years. She was separated from her three children. She probably doesn't know where they are. I mean, all this is speculative, but her motives are being cast as that she's an Al-Qaeda fanatic, and she could be just absolutely furious at the way she's been treated. She's an MIT graduate. I don't
know
the substance of it. But what I'm getting at it is, so much of the Bush administration's policies here seem to be designed to manipulate the American public.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a good point. In fact, I tell the story in the book after the Supreme Court rules in the Hamdan case, this enormous rebuff for the president. I mean, some people consider it the most important decision on presidential power ever. And the Supreme Court has just told him, you've just acted illegally. He turns around and says to Congress, okay, well, why don't you just authorize these for me? And, over the course of the summer of 2006, this battle plays out between Bush and a group of congressmen, including John McCain, over what these trials should look like. And, Bush is pushing when he really wants these trials to go forward, he calls a press conference at the White House, and he brings in all of the families of the victims of 9/11, and announces that they've just transferred 14 hardcore
al-Qaeda guys to Guantanamo, and that we have to, the Congress has to do this now. He certainly was using those levers as much as he could. And I think, you know, the point you raised at the very beginning about the remarks that the judge made down there to Hamdan, that I hope you'll get back to Yemen and be reunited with your family soon, is those remarks are significant because the Bush administration is reserving the right to hold Hamdan indefinitely until the end of hostilities in the war on terror, which could be, you know, well beyond my lifetime. So the military judge saying that, you know, does signal that the administration might have a problem on their hands if they don't let Hamdan go at a certain point.
Do you think we'll see another case come forward, one raising the issue of the indefinite incarceration of an individual who's completed his sentence?
Well, certainly if Hamdan is kept past this four-month period, there's no question we're going to see that case, and it's going to be brought by his lawyers. So it's going to be up to the administration in a way.
Well, let's take another call. A listener on line two in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Are they still allowing coerced and hearsay testimony? I read coerced as possibly torture.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're allowing basically a lot of what the situation now is that the judge has more authority to determine what can or can't be admitted, but it is still possible. I mean, it's up to him. And in this case, as I mentioned earlier, the Hamdan's defense lawyers made the argument that a number of his statements had been coerced and shouldn't be allowed, and the judge accepted their argument in many instances and throughout a number of the statements he'd made to interrogators in Afghanistan, though he did admit other statements he'd made that the defense argued had been coerced as well. So basically, the judge will have a lot of authority to determine what should and shouldn't be admissible.
Weren't some of these prisoners picked up for a ransom?
Yes, that's right. Hamdan himself was turned over for $5,000 bounty. That was the general policy.
And doesn't this detract from McCain's judgment in that he refuted the idea that these so-called enemy combatants should receive due process?
Well, McCain has been a little hard to pin down on all of these issues. In 2005, he got behind, he authored the McCain Amendment, which was to ban torture. But then in 2006, he was one of the principal authors of this Military Commissions Act, which made these military tribunals legal. And in this Military Commissions Act, one of the things he agreed to, certainly with pressure from the White House, was that these detainees wouldn't have access to the federal courts to challenge these verdicts. That has subsequently been overturned by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled only recently that element of this Military Commissions Act was unconstitutional and it was struck down. But McCain certainly voted for it. The other thing that McCain has not been willing to do on this issue is subject the CIA to the same standards that the regular military is subjected to in terms of interrogation. So he's basically not voted for legislation that would make the CIA accountable to the same interrogation standards as the Army.
And a final question, if I might, what do you think of Attorney Alan Dershowitz's statement saying that military justice compared to justice as we know it in this country is like military music compared to music?
I think he couldn't be more wrong, to be honest. I think these guys, these JAG lawyers, first of all, the military justice system, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, is a far cry from these military tribunals. There are a lot more protections, due process protections, in the Uniform Code of Military Justice than there are in these military tribunals. And the top JAG lawyers in all of the services
were urging the Pentagon, when these trials were first being created, to follow the same rules. And they said at the time, this is going to, it's all going to reflect badly on us, the military. We're going to be blamed if these trials don't look fair. Not only are we going to be blamed, but we're going to ultimately be putting our own soldiers at risk. Imagine one of our soldiers, or you know, many of our soldiers, get captured somewhere overseas and get subjected to a trial like this, where they're not allowed to see all the evidence brought against them. Are we going to be okay with that? You know, we have to subject, we have to give these guys the same trials we expect our guys to be given. So, so I think you know that they're the real heroes, frankly, in all of this.
I want to thank the listener for his call. Let's take another call now, a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, I actually view Swift as a true American hero, really. What about his?
So do I.
Yeah, what is his career then? I mean, you know, here's a guy that, you know, I don't know how much further, you know, in what he's in, how much higher could he go if he played the game, you know?
Well, he's out of the military.
Oh, he is. Okay. I didn't realize. Okay.
Yeah, he was not. He was not promoted. In fact, right within weeks of the Supreme Court decision coming down in 2006, he learned that he hadn't been promoted. And you know, in the military, it's if you're not promoted, basically it's up or out. You know, you're expected to leave. So he left. And there's obviously a lot of natural speculation about whether he was not promoted because of this effort that he waged on Hamdan's behalf, or whether it was his you know something else, his service record in general. So I think certainly the Hamdan defense had to have been a factor, but you know it is one could make other arguments for why Swift wasn't worthy of promotion, largely because he really had spent his whole career as a defense lawyer in the JAG Corps, and that's typically not the best path to promotion. Usually, you want to get out of the courtroom as soon as you can, and you want to be advising line commanders and people out. You know, mm-hmm. You want to be out on the high seas, basically telling people telling captains what's legal and what isn't legal. Mm-hmm. It was not easy for him to leave the military. He'd been in basically since the Naval Academy in college, and aside from a brief stint in law school, that had been his life. And it really, honestly, took him some time to kind of find his sea legs, if you'll excuse the metaphor, afterwards.
Journalist Jonathan Mahler, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. Well, we have not yet mentioned very much at all about this other fellow who is at the center of the story, these two characters, Charles Swift and then Neil Katyal, of course, Mr. Hamdan. But Neil Katyal, what an interesting character he is. A lifelong Democrat, you say he is a strong believer, or had been a strong believer, in executive authority and unusually hawkish on matters of national security.
Yeah.
So what were his first thoughts about the administration's plans for military commissions, which came about really very shortly after September 11th, and how did he get involved?
Yeah, he basically, Neil Katyal was at the time very, very bright young constitutional law scholar. He had worked, he had clerked on the Supreme Court. He'd gone to Yale Law School, clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice Breyer, and you know, in the world of the law, there's no better law school than Yale, and there's no better place to clerk than the Supreme Court, of course. So, and he went on to actually work in the Clinton Justice Department. But he was certainly a Democrat, though he was, as I write in the book, very, very hawkish, in particular on matters of national security, and he staked out that position both in the Clinton Justice Department and in his scholarly work. And in the aftermath of 9/11, he actually he's a professor at Georgetown, but he was doing a year visiting professor at Yale for the year in 2001, 2002. So on 9/11, he was in New Haven, and after 9/11, you know, he really found himself supporting all of these initially kind of aggressive moves on behalf of the
on behalf of the White House that the White House's aggressive actions to fight terrorism and expand executive authority in order to do so. And he was certainly on board the Patriot Act and a number of other actions. And it wasn't until the president issued this military order authorizing these military tribunals without first asking Congress, but rather by fiat, essentially, that Katyal felt, that's not right. This isn't how it's supposed to work. The same branch of government shouldn't be allowed to authorize these trials, choose the defendants for them, write the rules and define the crimes for which they're going to be tried. That's not right. And Congress has the power to make the rules. And so he wrote a law review article at the time criticizing these military tribunals. And the law review found its way into Swift's hands. And so Swift called Katyal at a certain point and asked if they could get together. And Katyal essentially began by tutoring Swift and one of his colleagues on the defense team, another JAG lawyer, on some of the constitutional issues that these military tribunals raised. And then when Swift was assigned to defend Hamdan, he knew that he wouldn't be able to handle the kind of constitutional aspect of the case by himself. He was a great trial lawyer, as good as anyone in a courtroom. But in terms of mounting the kind of sophisticated legal argument that could persuade federal judges, appeals court judges, and ultimately the Supreme Court, he knew he was going to need some help. So he called Katyal and said, "Hey, will you get on board?" And he told Katyal, "I think I have the perfect client." And he told Katyal he doesn't have any other lawyers, which was good. And he's never shot at anybody. Was not involved in any conspiracies. That's mm-hmm. the good news. And Katyal
and the
said,
bad
well,
news.
"What's the bad news?" And he said, "He's Osama bin Laden's driver." Yeah. So Katyal certainly spent some time thinking about whether or not he wanted to do this, because he knew, here he was a young rising star in the world of constitutional law, and he certainly had a big career ahead of him in government, having worked in the Clinton administration. And he knew that everything he'd done basically up until that point was going to be forgotten, and he was going to be known as the guy who defended bin Laden's driver. Mm-hmm. It was, as he saw it, really kind of going to, no matter what happened, it was going to kill his career. And that's what people told him, too. But he did it anyway.
Yeah, and what's the situation with him today? Has it taken a toll on his career?
No. In fact, on the contrary, he's kind of a rock star now, because he argued his very first case at the Supreme Court. And when the case, I detail this in the book, but when the case got to the Supreme Court, everyone told him, you can't make this argument. You've never argued at the Supreme. Not only have you never argued at the Supreme Court, you've barely argued inside a courtroom. I mean, he'd argued a traffic ticket, a speeding violation, and a landlord-tenant dispute when he was in law school and working on some sort of legal clinic. So, but he felt that he wanted to make the argument, and he insisted on doing it and prepared obsessively over the course of several months, organized moots all around the country with all of the law scholars and professors who intimidated him most. He specifically called them and asked them to come out and grill him. And he gave the argument himself against the Solicitor General of the United States, Paul Clement, who was there in the top coat and the outfit of the Solicitor General. And this guy, Paul Clement, is widely known as the best Supreme Court advocate of his generation. And Katyal, having never argued a case in his life, walked in there and won. And so you can imagine that it's done a lot for his reputation.
Yeah. I've got a let me sort through some papers here. I've got so many details here.
Sure.
There is a case set for trial at Guantanamo early next month, and this involves a Canadian captured at the age of 15.
Potter.
The charges include the murder of an American soldier in Afghanistan. What's the outlook for that case? Will it go forward?
Well, I would assume so, because what I would have said had Hamdan been
had he faced, you know, either a tougher sentence, or had he been convicted on both charges, his lawyers certainly would have appealed the case. I mean, they would have appealed. You're not allowed to appeal the verdict itself, but you're allowed to challenge the rules in the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. or in court, which ultimately, possibly in the Supreme Court. I would have said they would have done that, certainly. But given the favorable outcome, they're not going to. So that is, unless Hamdan isn't released in 4 months. So I would say that that challenge to the tribunals won't be there. So there's nothing standing in the government's way. The only question is, you know, do they feel that, you know, given how things turned out, that, you know, they might even things could be even worse. They might end up with an acquittal altogether, which they probably don't want. But at the same time, you know, they've invested so much in these tribunals that you know, I have to believe they are going to go forward with them.
Mm. And then shortly after that, on the schedule anyway, the trial of Khalid Sheikh
KSM.
Mohammed,
yeah.
KSM.
Yeah.
So that's a really big one, too,
that's
because
a big one.
That's
yeah.
a
and
death
you know,
penalty case.
Yeah, and you could argue that, and some think this, that you know, one of the things that the government is doing here is, you know, the reason why they tried Hamdan first and they're trying this guy Khadr next is that, you know, they wanted to basically get the kinks out. They wanted to try out the system with some you know, some lower level guys before they put one of the big guns like KSM in the dock and risked making a mistake, you know, or risked losing some critical statements or you know what have you. The problem is that, you know, given that a lot of the statements that Hamdan made were thrown out, and as I said earlier, Hamdan was believed to have been a very clean case, that the interrogations, at least the prosecutor believed the interrogations had all been above board, more or less. And then you take a guy like KSM, who has unquestionably been subjected to much harsher interrogations, you have to wonder what's going to be admissible and what isn't. Because clearly the judge down there has shown that he's not afraid to throw evidence out.
Hmm. We had a listener call in who we're not going to be able to get to this afternoon because of the time difficulties here. We're running down on time very quickly. He wanted to raise this point. His point of view is that the Geneva Convention has not been followed by any other country since World War I, according to my information here, with our soldiers, with American soldiers. So his question is, he seems to think we're going out of our way to follow the Geneva Conventions.
As well we should. I mean, I would say that that's what makes America America. That, you know, not to be too jingoistic here, but I mean, we hold ourselves to a certain standard, and, you know, how we treat enemy prisoners is not about them. It's about us. It's about the values we want to project. And you know, I don't think the fact that other countries don't treat prisoners as well as we do should be an excuse for us to treat them any differently. And you know, and I'm hardly the only one saying this. I mean, you know, hundreds of retired admirals and generals, you know, John McCain, Colin Powell, they all feel the same way about this. And, you know, I think it's something that we all need to keep in mind, and it's something it should be a source of pride for us.
Mm. Earlier this month, on August 3rd, 2008, a piece you wrote appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The Fog of War Crimes Trials. And at the end of the piece, you ask, what will the legacy of these war crimes trials be?
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about that question?
Sure.
Today?
Well, I mean, I think I have a couple of reactions to that. One is that, look, they're never going to be Nuremberg. These trials have just are so shrouded in controversy. So many questions over their legitimacy. There have been numerous challenges, successful legal challenges to them. So it's not they're certainly not going to be some great monument to the rule of law, to the triumph of reason over power that Nuremberg is and was and is and will always be. However, what I do think the legacy of these trials, or at least the Hamdan trial, will be is the notion that this guy
this suspected terrorist, now convicted terrorist, was assigned a defense lawyer who was a member of the U.S. military. And this guy, this member of the U.S. military, put on such an extraordinary defense of this guy that he brought his case to the Supreme Court, the highest court in America, got a hearing, won, changed these trials, maybe not changed them enough, but certainly changed them, and was down there, having been kicked out of the military, was down there in civilian clothes last week, still at his client's elbow. I mean, I think that, to me, is going to be one of the enduring legacies of this tribunal and these tribunals. And I think it's something we should all be enormously proud of. I mean, this is something that can you know, what other country could this happen in? Could a military officer and a law professor bring a lawsuit against a commander-in-chief during wartime and not only get a hearing, but win and force major policy changes? I mean, I think that's the lesson for me. That's the takeaway lesson for me.
Mm. Why do you think that the U.S. Supreme Court has been so tough on the executive over these issues?
That's a good question.
And I can give you about a minute.
Sure. Well, I have actually a fairly simple answer, as it turns out, that the Supreme Court has been so tough because Congress hasn't done anything. I think the Supreme Court basically has had to step in and do Congress's job, which is to say, check the executive, prevent the executive from abusing his authority. The way it's supposed to work is the executive and Congress are supposed to be pursuing their respective agendas aggressively and in so doing kind of checking each other. But here, Congress repeatedly sat back, you know, on its heels and let the executive draw up policies when it wanted to, when he wanted to, and left it to the courts basically to to pull our fat out of the fire. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's what happened. It was you know, congressional abdication was a large part of this.
And final question, 30 seconds.
Sure.
Now, is Congress going to step out of this malaise that
let's hope so. I mean, I think I do think that certainly one of the legacies of this administration and this, you know, the Congress during this administration should be that there should be a backlash. There should be an awareness going forward that that, you know, Congress has to stand up for itself. The problem is that, you know, you have, instead of people being loyal to Congress, instead of congressmen and women being loyal to Congress, they're loyal to their party. So what we need is to sort of rediscover this kind of institutional loyalty, this sort of pride in the House and the Senate and in the role they play in our divided government, instead of the kind of political loyalty.
There, we got to leave it. We're past time. Jonathan Mahler, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon. Jonathan Mahler is the author of The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld and the Fight Over Presidential Power. The book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux.
And that was from the AM 580 archives from last August 13th. It's 6 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in now from the CME Group. And with those numbers, here's AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Tom. Taking a look at the numbers in Chicago on a Tuesday, rather Thursday afternoon. Futures finished like this on the day before the USDA crop production report for September is released. That happens at 7:30 a.m. tomorrow morning. Some position squaring taking place in Chicago in the wheat pit. 7.14¾ was the high, the low at 6.99½. A settlement price at 7.07¼, up a half for the day. December 7.34¼, the high, the low at 7.14. Settlement price at 7.26¼, up a half. And March futures, 7.56, the high, the low at 37. Settlement price unchanged today at 7.48¾ for the March wheat. May futures, 7.67¾, the high, the low at 7.50. Settled 7.62¼, a quarter higher in July contract, up a penny and three quarters. The harvest month had a high of 7.78½, a low at 7.60¼, settlement price at $7.73¾, up 1¾. Spring wheat, December contract, a penny higher at 7.91, and December hard red winter wheat at 7.64¼, up a quarter for the day. From the corn pit in Chicago, nearby September futures, 5.26, the high, the low at 5.18½, a settlement price at 5.22 1/4, down 0.25 cents. Fairly narrow trading range for the recent weeks, certainly, as we head into tomorrow morning's crop production numbers for the corn December contract of 5.38 3/4 top, bottom at 5.31, settlement price at $5.33 1/4, down 3.5 cents. And the March futures, 5.59 1/2 on the composite trade high, the low at 5.50, settlement price at 5.52 1/4, down 3.5 for the day. May futures, 3.5 cents lower there as well. 5.69 1/4, the high, the low at 62 1/4, settlement price at $5.64 1/2, down 3.5. And July futures finished at 5.74 1/2, down 3.25, the high at 79 1/4, the low at 72 1/4, settlement price for the July contract in the corn pit at $5.74 1/2, down 3.25. Next year's December futures settled at $5.79. down a penny on the day. September oats at 317 were 7.5 lower. December had a high of 339, a low at 323, a settlement price at 330, down 7.5 for the December oat futures. Soybeans now September contract, 12.18 1/4 the high, the low at $11.70 3/4, settlement price up 34.5 cents. It's the only gainer in the pit at $12.16. Once again, the September futures finished 34.5 cents higher. The rest of those contracts were just narrowly lower. November beans, $11.88, the high, the low at $11.65. Settlement price at $11.76, down 2. January, $12.04, the high, low at $11.81 1/4. Settlement price at $11.92 1/4, down 2.5. March futures, 12.14 3/4, the high, the low at $11.95. Settlement price at $12.06 1/2, 2 1/4 lower. And the May contract in the bean pit, 12.25, the high, the low at $12.01 3/4. Settlement price 3.5 cents lower at $12.13. November soybeans, 4 cents lower, $11.75, the high, the low at 54.5, a settlement price at $11.62, down 4 on the afternoon. September bean meal futures, 350, the high, the low at 335, settlement price at 350, up $13.20. October, 331.50 for the bean meal, up $5.60. September bean oil futures, 47.34, the high, the low at $47, settlement price for 100 pounds at $47 even, down 69 cents for the bean oil. And the October bean oil, 48.27, the high, the low at 46.98, settlement price at 47.12, down 72 cents on the afternoon. During the closing market report this afternoon, which is now just about 9 minutes away, we'll talk with Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group. He's located in Decatur, Illinois. He'll help us make sense of what tomorrow's numbers might look like from the United States Department of Agriculture. Crop production and supply and demand, or WASDE, numbers are due out at 7:30 a.m. October live cattle futures from the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago, $102.60, the high today, the low at $101.35, and a settlement price at $102.05, 40 cents higher. December futures, $103.45, the high, the low at $102.40, settlement price at $103.25, up 22.5 cents. February futures, $105 even, the high, the low at $103.90, settlement price at $104.75, 7.5 cents higher. April contract, $105.50, the high, the low at $104.30, settlement price at $105.27.5, up 2.5 cents. And the feeder cattle, September contract, $109.95, the high, the low at $109.10, settlement price at $109.65, 20 cents higher for the day. October futures, $109.30, the high, the low at $108, settlement price at $108.57.5, down 32.5 cents. November in the feeder cattle pit, $108.90, the high, the low at $107.75. The November contract for the feeders down a dime at $108.57.5. January futures, $108.30, the high, the low at $107.40, settlement price at $108, down 2.5 cents. Lean hog futures now, October contract, $69, the top, the bottom at $67.30, settlement price at $68.62.5, $1.12.5 higher for the afternoon. December futures, $67.10, the high, the low at $65.35, settlement price at $66.97.5, 80 cents higher. In the February futures, $73.95, the high, the low at $72.35, settlement price at $73.75, finished 50 cents higher on the afternoon. April contract for the lean hogs, $80.70, the high, the low at $79.15, settlement price at $80.30, a nickel lower. Pork bellies, February contract, 87.15. The high, the low at 85.10. Settlement price at 86.90, $1.17.5 higher. And the March contract at 86.50 finished down 25 cents. It's the top of the hour, 2 o'clock Central Time. Straight up, you're listening to WILL 580.